Britain has a new government. How might its role in the world change under Prime Minister Keir Starmer?
2024 is an interesting year because I think more people are going to the polls this year on planet Earth than any time.
The UK election results bucking the trend toward right-wing politics across Europe. Is it a sign of a shift or just voter dissatisfaction?
I just think it's what the country needs. We just need a change. We need somebody with a different vision. You know, it's not just about me and how much money I've got in my pocket. We've got to think about everybody.
And in the United States, will the Supreme Court's decision on presidential immunity change how American democracy works?
It grants the new president limitless power.
Today is Saturday, July 6th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. Britain has a new government and a new prime minister.
We did it! You campaigned for it, you fought for it, you voted for it, and now it has arrived. Change begins now.
Voters in the UK cast their ballots Thursday in a landslide victory for its Labour Party.
It feels like young people were voting this year because we really needed a change, like very desperately. So it's really good to wake up this morning and feel like there's something in the air that feels different. I feel like London was stuck at a big standstill and I feel like we weren't progressing or moving. And I think we had a Conservative Parliament for so long and everyone was struggling underneath that for so long. And it kind of felt hopeless. So today feels like a win in the sense for younger people that we might have some hope in our future that we might not have had a couple months ago or a couple of years ago.
The results were a major defeat for Conservatives in power under five prime ministers for more than a decade.
Disappointed that Labour has won, but obviously not surprised at all. We did see it coming.
Associated Press correspondent Neon Kim in London has more on the new leader of Britain.
Keir Starmer is officially the Prime Minister after receiving the formal blessing of King Charles, arriving at 10 Downing Street with his wife Victoria to roaring applause from supporters. In his first speech as PM, Starmer vows to lead a government of service, marking the beginning of a new Britain.
Politics can be a force for good. We will show that. We've changed the Labour Party, returned it to service, and that is how we will govern. Country first, party second.
Starmer wants citizens of all political colours to join his project of change with stability.
I invite you all to join this government of service in the mission of national renewal.
Outgoing leader Rishi Sunak earlier offered his resignation to the King after his party's crushing defeat. Neon Kim, London.
Joining us now for some perspective on what the landslide election could signify is Tim Helwig from the University at Buffalo. He's a professor of political science with a focus on the politics of European nations, the European Union, immigration and trade in Europe. Thank you for being with us. So, was this a surprise or was it expected?
It wasn't surprising in the sense that all the polls had been pointing in this direction. It's surprising in the sense that it's huge. It's a landslide. It's a huge victory, almost rivaling Labour's 1997 historic win after they had been out of power for 17 years. Now they had been out of 10 Downing Street for 14 years this time. So in comparison to, you know, American politics, this is huge because in Britain, you've had the situation where you have one party control government for over a decade, you know, almost 15 years plus, and then it's just back to the other. And now we've had a period of 14 years and it's coming to an end of Conservative Party rule and Labour will take over. So it's not so much surprising, but it's nonetheless very important and fundamental because of the huge shift this is going to involve in policy probably, and also because it's been such a long time coming.
What do you see as major changes that we'll see in UK policies, and what do you think the message from voters was?
Well, I think there's two messages from voters. One is that they're tired of I would say maybe unprofessional leadership or more personal leadership over practical leadership. You know, I think the last, at least especially since the Brexit referendum in 2016 and promises to get Brexit done, get out of the European Union. But even before that, going back to the aftershock of the 2008 financial crisis, British politics has been kind of extreme, kind of more bluster than actually following through with policy promises and delivering things that haven't helped, you know, bottom line kind of economic issues. And so I guess that's sort of one, just ready for more quote unquote normal politics, I think. Normalcy is one message that the voter's been sending. And Keir Starmer, I guess the top line on him is that he's dull and technocratic and more of an administrator than a charismatic leader. And I think that sort of fits the bill right now, because there's been maybe too much excitement after some of these crises in British politics, and Britain is not doing as well economically and stably as some of its European neighbors. And so I guess that was, you know, that's the one message is to normalcy. And the second one is, I think going more into policies, I think there really is a need to grow the economy. Going back to the earliest days of back in 2010, when the Conservative Party first took over in this 14-year run, they really came in with austerity. They came in by tightening the screws on the economy, tamping down spending, doing less, and a lot of people were thrown into poverty, inequality rose, and there might have been an effort to try to shore up budget finances. That's what they did. And then after that, you got Brexit, and that was chaos. And so right now, I think people would like to just see loosening of fiscal policy, spending more, giving resources to businesses, listening to labor movements and unions, and just trying to really focus on growing the short-term economy in a way that hasn't been the focus for decades, really.
It's interesting because this election is certainly bucking the trend of Europe's shift to right-wing and autocratic-leaning leaders have been seemingly gaining ground.
Yes, that's the other top line story here. When you think about this in comparative perspective in other countries, and to a certain extent the United States as well, if we want to think about the policies of past and future Trump administrations kind of being more far right. But I think the main story is that you happen to have a center right government and the Conservatives being in office for a long time. Things hadn't going well, and people wanted to change. And the most obvious change would be to go to the center-left. And in British politics, unlike France, we have an election on Sunday, or in the Netherlands that elected a far-right government. You don't have a strong far-right option. Traditionally, the Conservative Party has been able to tamp that down and incorporate those elements of, like, anti-immigration or anti-European Union, anti-foreigner elements into its own center-right story, whereas the small radical far-right movements, such as in the Reform Party in Britain, have not gathered enough steam. They have not developed as those parties have in Germany or France or the Netherlands or other countries. So I think it's not so much, in my view, it's not so much that the British public is more social democratic than some of those other countries, but the party side hasn't risen to meet the challenge, as it were, and therefore I think along with those things, the only reasonable change agent was to go to the center left, and the Labour Party. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not Labour governs from the left and takes this mandate as you say, you know, bucking the trend and saying the public want more, you know, socialist or leftist policies, or are they going to govern from the center and take their mandate to mean, well, we realize why we're here is just because we're not the other guys, right? And there's nothing special about us other than we're not them. So I'm a little skeptical that Britain is all that different from some of these other countries that are going rightward. It's just that they've had a particularly difficult last 14 years. And I think they've sort of, the British public is more willing to, again, go for some sort of normalcy, whereas some other countries haven't been through the same kind of turmoil, for better or worse. And that's why you see some more radical right kind of growth in those other countries.
Would you say there's anything we can take from this election that might provide any sort of clues as to what potentially could happen in the United States. Things are very upended right now in the U.S. as far as the presidential campaign. And does this give you any sort of sense of what could happen here?
I think it's very difficult. In my reading, in Britain, you have a very clear sense that one set of people have been in charge for a long time and they deserve to get out. In the U.S., it's not quite the similar thing, because if Trump wins, it's essentially a vote for the same leadership we had 4 years ago. So it's a much less long-term perspective. If we are trying to kind of grasp at straws and try to draw a connection here, I see the British and American publics as both going into these respective elections as not terribly enamored with their choices, right? So the big story in the United States is that both President Biden and former President Trump have historical lows of popularity. I don't know if we ever had two presidential candidates that are more disliked. So it's really a choice of which you like less. I think there was a little bit of that in Britain as well, is that it was really the Conservatives and Rishi Sunak versus Labour and Keir Starmer. There wasn't that there was a love fest for one or the other, especially for Starmer, but definitely the voters had less reason to dislike him more than Rishi Sunak on the Conservatives. So that's a parallel that comes up for me. You know, I do see in this, I am worried about the United States and the fate of democracy in our election in the fall. Whereas in Britain, I think it was a good outcome for stability. I don't think it would have been a terrible outcome if the Conservatives had won. But I think the politics in Britain today are more moderate compared to the United States, right? You've got some more extreme elements on both sides, but they're smaller. And therefore, I don't think that this election, while it was in Britain, while it's extremely important for the reasons I said, you know, earlier in our conversation, it was expected, and it kind of is a re-equilibrating election, is political scientists talk, right? So you had long periods from one side to the other, now we're bouncing back to the other, whereas the United States election, I worry that we'll either have a more extreme government, or maybe a government that doesn't respect the Constitution as much, or we'll have a government that's sort of run out of energy, depending on which of our two candidates win the election in November. 2024 is an interesting year because I think more people are going to the polls this year on planet Earth at any time in our history. We've had elections in India. We've had elections I'd say the Indian election, the British election. These are cases where I think it's validations that democracy works, but then we have to wonder about elections in France or maybe in the United States about what that's going to say about our election. So it's an exciting year and a very consequential year.
Tim Helwig, University at Buffalo, Professor of Political Science. Thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Vowing to stay in the race after concerns over his poor debate performance last week, President Joe Biden heads into a make-or-break stretch for his imperiled campaign, with the election 4 months away. Speaking at Thursday's White House July 4th celebration, Biden responded to a man yelling, "Keep up the fight."
"You got me, man. I'm not going anywhere. All right."
In an interview for the Earl Ingram Show on the Civic Media Radio Network, Biden said the risks of electing Donald Trump extend beyond his own political prospects to the future of democracy.
"The Supreme Court just issued a decision, by the way, that threatens American principle that we have no kings in America. There's no one above the law."
Biden was referring to the U.S. Supreme Court's final session ruling, which granted former President Donald Trump substantial criminal immunity for actions taken in office. In April, before last week's decision, Trump told the press that presidents need immunity to do their job.
"This has to do with a president in the future for 100 years from now. If you don't have immunity, you're not going to do anything. You're going to become a ceremonial president."
Constitutional experts say the ruling could have far-reaching implications for the American political system, expanding the power and impunity of future presidents. Joining us now for analysis on the ruling and the country going forward is Doron Kallir, senior clinical professor of law and the director of the Appellate Practice Clinic at Cleveland State Law.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. So what exactly do you see this decision saying?
I think the most important lesson that we can learn from this opinion is that despite the majorities paying lip service to the principle that no person is above the law in the United States, from this day forward, there is one person that stands high and mighty above the law, and that person is the President of the United States. In fact, in a way, the Supreme Court vindicates Nixon's famous saying that was considered outrageous when it was first uttered in 1977, when he said, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal. Today, the Supreme Court says that's exactly right. If the president does it as a president, that means it is not illegal. And that's just a scary thought.
Is there something in the Constitution that aligns with the Supreme Court's decision?
The Constitution's text has nothing in it suggesting that the president will enjoy immunity. The entire opinion by the Chief Justice is based on the principle of separation of powers and the special place that the president, which is the only person who is also an arm of the government, he himself is a branch, the executive branch. Article 2 begins with the executive power of the United States shall be vested in the president of the United States. So it's unlike the Supreme Court, which consists of 9, and Congress, which consists of 535 members, the arm of the government, which is the executive branch, is vested in one person. And that person, the Constitution said, is the president. But if the Constitution says something about immunity of the president, it's the exact opposite, as Justice Sotomayor mentioned in her dissent. It says that even if the president is impeached and convicted, he can still stand trial, meaning that the Constitution itself, in its text, envisioned the president standing trial, but apparently not our Supreme Court. And I want to say another thing about something that the Supreme Court said, the majority opinion said, and did not receive, in my mind, not only enough press, but any press. Until today, there was a huge argument in the United States among judges and scholars whether a president can grant himself a reprieve. And the Supreme Court closed the door on that question in this opinion by saying that the immunity, that power is one of the core powers of the president, and therefore it is not subject to any law or judicial review. And so if the president will pardon himself, this is not even reviewable by any court in the United States, which is, again, if you were to tell me that a week ago, I would laugh in your face. I would say this is a bad joke. But that means that not only can the president do everything that the Supreme Court allowed him to do without any consequence or trial, but he can do much worse than that, as in, of course, sending SEAL Team 6 to murder his political rivals, and then grant pardon to himself, which is not reviewable by any court. The power of pardon, the Supreme Court said, is so absolute that it cannot be reviewable by any court. And that's obviously to me that the Chief Justice, with all the respect, did not even contemplate this scenario where the president is actually doing something far and away from so-called his official capacity, but then grants himself a reprieve. But the Supreme Court said the pardon power is the core power of the president, and those powers are not reviewable by any court ever. It's a complete and absolute immunity. And I think taken together, those two statements are just not only putting him above the law, but putting him instead of perpetual impunity. Like, whatever he wants to do, he can do. I really don't think that the Supreme Court actually contemplated the meaning and the ramification of its decision with regards to a second Trump administration or to the current cases around the country. And in a sense, I think this decision blew a death sentence to all of Trump's trials. Just like he said, he was totally exonerated by this opinion, which is, in my mind, crowns this opinion as literally one of the worst ever issued by the United States Supreme Court, and way above and beyond Trump amateurish lawyers have argued or even wished for. The decision is so much wider, more comprehensive, and more granting than the meager briefs that were submitted by his lawyers, that it's just staggering. If ever the term Trump's court was justified, anything Trump's want and more, as Justice Sotomayor wrote, it's not only my opinion, 3 justices of the Supreme Court wrote that he got everything he wanted and more.
The way many people have read this and the way it appeared was that a president is immune from criminal prosecution when it comes to official duties as president, but they are subject to criminal prosecution if, while president, they are doing something that is not in the realm of their official presidential duties. Is that how it always was? And is that how it appears? Or is there more to that?
So this is a very good question. And again, the dissent is asking the same exact question. To take a step back, as the Chief Justice writes in the beginning of his opinion, this case is the first criminal prosecution in our nation's history of a former president for action taking during his presidency. So this is really writing on a clean slate. Never before has a president been charged with criminal offenses relating to his administration. The Supreme Court is trying now to create a distinction between the president's official act and unofficial act. And in fact, his own lawyers have conceded during oral argument that some of the acts that are claimed in the indictment are indeed unofficial acts. But the Supreme Court does not agree with that. The majority opinion basically says that everything that you do while you're sitting in the White House is an official act. They go all the way, in their own words, not mine, to the outer limits, the power of the presidency to say that everything that he's doing is an official act.
Did they say everything that a president does is an official act while he's in office? Or do they say that needs to be looked at?
No, they used the term outer limits, and they said that everything enjoyed at least, in their words, again, everything enjoys at least a very strong presumption of official act. It is the job of the government from now on to persuade the court in order to reverse that presumption, to rebut that presumption that what the president has done was an unofficial act. Not a single act that the president has done according to the indictment, including his attempt to reverse the legal and lawful election of President Biden, not one of the many acts that are charged in the indictment are recognized by the Supreme Court in this opinion as an unofficial act. Not one. And all of them, in their mind, are either absolute power or presumed to be within the president's official act.
What does this mean for the future of the United States and the legal system of how this country operates?
Well, I really think that it may endanger, should an anti-democratic president, again, current nominee Trump, will be elected president, this opinion provides him with a roadmap to literally destroy American democracy with complete immunity. To the extent that any of his actions will be decided to be outside the perimeters of official action, he can still pardon himself, and that too will be unreviewable by the courts. And so it grants the new president limitless power to destroy American democracy. And I am completely fearful, much like the dissent is, for the future of democracy in this country following this opinion.
Does this decision have the ability to have any other impact as far as how the United States engages with the rest of the world and the world engages with the U.S.?
Yes, I do think that the opinion may reverberate throughout our relations with other nations. When the United States is distinguished from countries like Russia and Iran and North Korea, we always mention the checks and balances and the idea that the president is not all-powerful to make a decision and act on them, as, for example, President Putin is, or Ayatollah Khamenei, or anybody else. But from now on, we're joining a very limited and unenviable club of nations where the president, the chief executive, is above the law and may act accordingly. Now, it's very important to again emphasize that for 235 years, no president felt the need to be shielded in that way because they all felt that the criminal code is the limit by which they live. We had 46 presidents until today, none of whom, maybe except with the exception of one, felt the need to seek complete immunity from the courts because they all realized that they were selected, as the Constitution clearly states, to uphold the law and to faithfully execute the law. That's actually the constitutional obligation of every president, is to make sure that the laws are faithfully executed. And this former president went to the Supreme Court, sought complete immunity, and got a lot more than what he asked for. And now the eyes of the world are looking at us and thinking, why? Why did you grant him so much power? And I think it definitely will not contribute to either our stand in the world or, more importantly to me as a jurist, to the standing of the United States Supreme Court as one of the leading institutions of law in the world.
That was Cleveland State University's Senior Clinical Professor of Law, Doron Collier. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.